Welcome back to the podcast. It's been a long time. It's been a long time. And you know, last season was rough. I was going every other week, and then I was going every other 2 weeks. Our episode flow was just not where it was in the first two seasons. And I do apologize about that, but you know, we're winding things down in a way so that the podcast is more manageable for me, but also where I'm able to continuously do it. The problem is the weekly episodes were getting really, really hard given all the projects that I have going on. However, I am aware that we didn't wind down last season properly. Like usually I'll do an end of the season episode and I make it clear this is the end of the season, yada, yada, yada. I basically threw up two episodes. One was an audio commentary for my film Death and Life. The other was an audio commentary for my film Fractals. And then that was that. And the reason that was that is because, one, I have two movies going simultaneously that I'm trying to get made. And one of them is already underway. The other one starts shooting in a matter of weeks. And then I also have big news regarding sort of my life. You know, as some of you know, I've had a baby. I had a baby in February. I've talked about it on this podcast. Well, I've talked about her on this podcast. Well, you know, I decided to reevaluate being in New York City, given everything that's going on in the country, given the economic uncertainty, given that I really don't need to be in New York anymore, and given the time frame, the timeline of it all, I decided to relocate me and my entire family and my entire production operation to my home state of Maine. And so I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about how that all went down. But before I do, I just want to give you some news about a previous guest. Last season, we had on Jessie Bender. She is an author and a publisher. And she was in episode 94, What We Stand to Lose. It's actually a really important episode. And I wanted to let you know that one of the pieces that we were talking about, which also functions as a performable stage play, is actually being performed in Brooklyn, and the tickets are on sale. This was Kinder Krankenhaus, and it is at the Brick Theater in Brooklyn, New York. And I'm going to put the info down in the show notes about it, because, you know, we want to support our guests who have been on this show. And so when she wrote me like that this is happening, I'm like, oh crap, I've left New York, so I can't really go. Not that I'm not willing to go to New York for a show. It's just like I just moved 2 weeks ago. I'm still settling in, and I'm also trying to wind up a film project that's going to be done this autumn, which I'm going to talk to you guys about. So I'm really not in a position just to go back to New York at the moment. So, I mean, I'm still in the process of flipping my registration over and all that. So I will, however, announce it on this podcast. And so this is the announcement for Jessie Bender's Kinder Krankenhaus. Tickets on sale now for the Brick Theater in Brooklyn, New York. Again, the info will be in the show notes. So where do I begin with this slew of creative updates, this slew of holy crap, Eric moved out of New York updates? Let's talk about the move from New York first. So it's been a long time coming. You know, when I moved to New York, Labor Day weekend of 2003, I'd given myself a decade. I'm like, if I can last a decade, I will have learned more about the world than my parents combined. Because New York City, everything is just elevated to a level where you're just forced to understand how to exist in the world. And if you can't, you basically die. Like, that's how hard New York is. And you know what? I lasted a decade, constantly looking back at me, longing for it, especially in the summer months. And then, you know, I eventually, you know, I ended up with Jan, who we met in 07, moved in together in 08. And it was a really fast turnaround on the relationship. But it was an arrangement where, like, we wanted to pursue film together. We wanted to pursue media together. Ultimately, though, she found a passion for data and analytics and got work with some PR agencies. And so I ended up returning to sort of a solo filmmaking operation with her kind of helping me out here and there when she could. and that's fine. And then over the pandemic, you know, we weren't part of the big New York exodus. I actually resented all those people. I'm like, you guys have no passion. You are just scared shitless. And you know what? I don't blame them, but at the same time, I hated them. And I'm a really, really severe asthmatic. I was the most at risk of anyone else, you know, in that city for COVID-19. But I was a lot less concerned about it because I understood the science behind it. I understood that social distancing works and that you can live in a city if you're willing to social distance. I honestly think that people just got overly paranoid in regards to, you know, we're going to up and move right now. And, you know, for over a year, you couldn't get a U-Haul truck. You know, you had to book it way in advance and all that. I didn't try, but I know that, like, I had some actors lined up for a film project called Fractals that I've talked a lot about on here because that was the previous feature film that I'd made. And I ended up letting them all go because they all, like, escaped to places like New Hampshire or Massachusetts, like the Berkshires. The Massachusetts Berkshires is a wonderful place to end up if you're trying to escape a city. But, you know, Fractals is a very pro-New York movie. Like, it's all about staying in New York against the odds. So I couldn't have the same people that I had previously cast actually being in this movie. And so what I did was, because COVID shut down my production, I resurrected it in the summer of 2020. Basically, as soon as New York lifted sanctions on productions, I got to work. And I, you know, it's the same film, but also it's not the same film. It's clearly a product of pandemic era New York in that very few people have scenes together in the same room, which wasn't the case initially. Everybody in the movie either stayed in New York or were just willing to come to New York. As long as we played it safe, as long as we had masks, social distancing, you know, I gave everybody gift bags with sanitizer and masks and all that stuff. Like, we were able to make our pro New York movie with people who weren't totally flaky about being in New York. And when I left New York, my mindset was for the past 20 years was if I leave New York, it has to be on my own terms. I'm not going to be run out. I'm not going to be returning back to Maine with my tail between my legs. I have to build myself up and leave on my own terms. And that's exactly what I did. Because after my first decade in New York, I gave myself another decade. I said, let's go 10 more years and see what happens. And I really, this final decade was really where I got everything kind of situated with myself. You know, I went back to school. I got my bachelor's degree at SUNY Empire State College. And then I went on right after that, 3 months later, I started my MFA program at Sarah Lawrence, which the Sarah Lawrence campus is located in Bronxville, New York, just north of New York City. And, you know, I got my driver's license in my mid-30s. I didn't have my license before that. I already knew how to drive a car because I drove illegally quite extensively when I was living in Maine. But that's another story. But I officially got licensed and I bought my first car, traded that in a few years later and got my second car, which I have now. And it was just sort of like a growing up took place over the second decade I was in New York. And I found my voice as a writer. I found my voice as a filmmaker. I started working in other artistic mediums. I learned how to work with acrylics and later oils. I mean, one of the electives that I took at SUNY Empire was a watercolor, intro to watercolor. Like, and that blew my mind because the last time I'd worked with watercolors was in elementary school. I had no idea you could create fine art with it. And you really can. Oh my goodness. What I learned about that medium, it just flipped a switch in my mind. And so that last decade in New York has been incredibly rewarding for me. And I'm so glad I stuck it out. But after Sophie was born and seeing kind of where my podcast was, what the film projects I wanted to do were, I realized I didn't need to be in New York anymore. I have other New York stories, but I wasn't that passionate about telling them. A lot of them don't necessarily need to be New York stories. And I'm like, you know what? It's the stories I'm most passionate about, can be done in Maine or have to be done in Maine. Because I am originally from Maine. I'm from the Casco Bay region of the state of Maine, which is in southern Maine. And I really just kind of want to focus on trying to get these movies made however which way I can. And so with Sophie in the picture and not wanting to raise her in New York for a lot of reasons, namely because the red line history still affects how the school districts are there, I'm just like, you know what, screw New York. Like, I've gotten what I could out of it, or what I needed out of it. There'll always be a place in my heart for it, but this place hasn't really loved me back as much as I really need it to in order to warrant the incredible expense it takes to live there. It's really expensive to live there, and it doesn't not always give back what you're putting into it. And I'm just like, I am ready to move back to Maine. I am ready to learn about my home state, how to live there on my own accord, you know, under my own terms. Because, you know, when I left Maine, it was also when I left my parents' house. I was living with my parents every time I lived here. And I never really lived here on my own terms. And I resented Maine for that. I resented Maine. It's so hard that I failed to really adequately learn its history. I knew more about New York history than I ever knew about Maine history. And I'm now just starting to read books and watch documentaries about the history of Maine so that I'll be as informed about Maine as I've been about New York for the past 20 years. And so basically what happened over the spring is I started talking to my sister about it. I said, I'm going to give myself till the end of the summer. Everything about wanting to relocate out of New York coincided with Sophie being born, with the film projects that I'm now ready to do, with sort of where I want to be in life, both physically and mentally. I just want to be more at peace and not always watching my back, not always looking over my shoulder. But it also coincided with the sale of our apartment building. The apartment where we were renting for the past 8 years, I guess. I mean, we moved in there in January of 2015. You know, we were addicted to that apartment, not because we liked living there or we liked the neighborhood, but it was because it was cheap. It was a great deal. We had a full floor of a townhouse in St. George, New York, walkable to the ferry, the free ferry to Lower Manhattan, which only takes 15 to 20 minutes. 25 minutes if you include the disembarkation time. But that, you know, we were paying just a hair over $1,000 a month for a one-bedroom, full-floor townhouse, you know, of a townhouse. Like, in New York City, that is addictive rent. I know in some places you'd be like, you're paying $1,000 a month for an apartment. That's expensive. In New York, that's pennies on the dollar, okay? That's pennies on the dollar. It was cheap and it was addictive. And that's why we were there for so long. That's the longest rental I've ever had. Previous to that, we either got evicted a lot because we couldn't make the rents for one reason or another. Or we were forced to leave due to other circumstances. For example, the reason we found the place we were in for so long was because the previous apartment had a mold issue and Jan got rushed to the hospital in an ambulance. And as soon as we got the ambulance bill, we're like, fuck, our landlord isn't going to reimburse us for this ambulance bill. This is a fortune. This is over $1,000. We need to get out of Dodge. So we moved out of that apartment in the middle of the night. We didn't pay our back rent on that. We basically, as soon as we discovered where the mold was, we pulled down the wall. It was where the wall and a sort of an inclined ceiling sort of meet up. There was a little bit of a hole. So we dug out that hole and found the mold. And we're like, fuck this shit. And we left. And we never heard back from that landlord. He didn't try to sue us. He didn't try to sue us for the back rent or the damage. I think they probably went into that apartment and were like, oh, fuck, you know, we are in breach of some shit. And that was that. By that point, though, I had already repaired a lot of our credit. My credit especially, I'd focused hard on repairing it. And I was already now going back to school. This was at the start of my bachelor's endeavor. And so I'm like, this is great. I'm moving into a new apartment that doesn't have a mold issue. And I'm able to just kind of focus on my studies rather than on the dilapidated place where we are living. And so that's, I think that's why we spent 8 years there, because it was just like, it was a fresh start. It was much needed, fresh start, and got a lot done. That one apartment accounts for the most successes I had in the last decade I was in New York. Think about that. So I'm listening to my cats in the next room. I'm like, what the hell are they doing? It's like they're stomping their back feet like rabbits or something. Anyway, I'll try not to be too distracted by them. And now I'm distracted by another cat outside. Okay, so there's this cat outside also named Sophie. And so sometimes I'll say, hey, Sophie. And my baby will look, because, you know, my baby's 6 months old now this month. And she can identify her name. She identifies Sophie as an important word, which I find fascinating. Anyway, I'm talking about the last decade I was in New York. So everything that I'm most proud of when it comes to my time in New York was done in this apartment in St. George, New York, in the BA, the MFA, Death and Life, Fractals, a lot of my creative writing, a lot of my best poetry, a lot of my best essays. I got first published in a literary journal, and then a second literary journal, and then a third literary journal from work that I either wrote or developed in that apartment. There's only one story that I got published that I didn't actually write in that apartment. I wrote it in upstate New York, but I was technically living in that apartment at the time. But, you know, it's just like the only thing that is meaningful for me as a creative writer that I didn't write there was my novella Objects and Giants. But I, of course, edited it there. I wrote it right before we moved there. In like one fell swoop, I just wrote it. And then we moved. And then I edited the thing and retooled the language and fine-tuned the language over many, many months. And yeah, I mean, that apartment was incredibly important to us. And I can't even begin to tell you all the stuff Jan accomplished there. That's her story. I'm just telling you my story, what I accomplished. And of course, on the personal side of it, we realized that we were really lonely. This is what happened with the great New York exodus. You know, everything we'd built hinged on our social lives always being intact. But when everybody left New York or stopped, you know, being sociable, you know, social distancing and all that, we're like, wow, this is really fucking lonely. And then we decided to have a kid. And you know what? We decided to do it. It wasn't like a fluke where two people meet, get really horny, and then they have a kid and it's not planned, and then the kid is miserable because their parents don't know what they're doing, which is basically the story of most parents, I feel like. We were able to plan for this. We were able to decide, you know what? I've built myself up and become emotionally mature. Jan is now really emotionally mature. We're both emotionally mature, much more than we were before. You know, when we met, we definitely weren't. And so we're like, you know what? I think we could do this. I think we should try doing this because I'm ready. I know what projects I want to do. I feel like I can fit them in, you know, and I'm okay with my story. Like, my story isn't the story of, you know, successful filmmakers in the United States, but I'm still making movies. And I'm the only one from my film school class who's making movies. So you know what? I don't need my entire life to focus on this anymore, because I know how to do it. I know how to do it as a job, but I also just know how to do it as a pastime, as something that I'm doing. I'm not going to say the word hobby. Hobby is my pet peeve word. I can't stand that word. But I just kind of know how to do it as a way of life, which was the whole goal for the past few years, was how do I turn filmmaking into a way of life? So that it's just kind of naturally fitting into my mode of operation. And so, and it has, and it is. And, so we had a kid in February. She was born, as you know, Sophie. And then it's like, all right, you know, Labor Day weekend of 2023 will be the 20th anniversary of my move to New York City. So that's my deadline for getting out. You know, the apartment building was sold also in February. All this came together. It all coincided. This acceptance and realization of my story. I love my story. I know what it is now. But, you know, the fact that Sophie was born the same month that our building was sold, I'm like, shit. Whether we stay addicted to this rent or not, we're going to probably have to leave, because they're going to either raise the rent to an amount that we're not willing to pay, because it's kind of a dump. It wasn't a dump when we moved in because we were comparing it and contrasting it with our previous place. But now that Sophie's in the picture, it's unfit. We, you know, you can't raise a baby in a walk up like that, especially one that isn't particularly well maintained. And so I gave myself till the end of the summer. I said, I will have been here 20 years by the time we leave. And that's perfect. Labor Day to Labor Day, 03 to 2023. So in the spring, I started coming up to Maine, transporting bins to my sister's garage. I've always had a lot of my property enclosed in plastic tote bins. So I would just pack them into the sedan and drive them up and look for apartments. And I did a lot of the looking in late June and early July. And eventually I looked in Bangor. I didn't look in Portland as much. I looked in Portland online, but I never visited any apartments in Portland because I'm from Portland originally. I went to high school at Portland High School. That's where I graduated high school. But Portland is out of control. Like, the rent is incredible. It's almost like Boston or New York prices. And of course, without the Boston and New York sort of access to industry and other creative types, I didn't see it as worth it. You know, it's still very much a fishing town, a port city. So the rent doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm just like, I'm going to avoid the Portland metro area and I'll start looking elsewhere. So I looked in Brunswick, which is technically in the Casco Bay area, but further north. But again, anything in the Casco Bay region, the prices are just in too out there. Like, they don't make sense to me. But of course, I'm coming at this region as somebody who grew up there. And when you grow up in a place and you see what people are paying to move to that place, you're like, why? And I feel like I'm not the only one who's like that. I'm sure people who grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area are wondering why the hell it's so expensive now, why somebody would move there and pay the enormous sums of money to be there. I'm like that. I'm like, why? It makes no sense to me. And so I looked in Bangor, but Bangor was really locked down by this management company that I found their practices to be really skeevy. One of the things that this management company wanted was they wanted you to have a substantial savings in the event that you couldn't make your rent. They said, you know, if you really want this apartment, you'll have to provide proof of savings. And this is one of the biggest management companies in Bangor. Pretty much almost every listing is through this company. I'm not going to name them, but you could probably hunt them down. And I'm just, in my head, I'm like, that doesn't make sense. How is that legal that you can require that? Or just like, you know, want it? Like, what American after the pandemic has a savings? I mean, it's so unreasonable to me. So I kind of stopped looking in Bangor altogether. I'm like, you know, Bangor isn't ready for good people. As long as they're letting this company run, you know, their rentals. I looked in Waterville. I looked in a small town called Fairfield, which was so much like a rural Texas town with their football field and their train tracks and all that. I'm just like, yeah, I can't be in Fairfield. And so I also looked in Augusta, which is the capital of the state of Maine. A lot of people might not realize that. Augusta is the capital of Maine. It's the political capital. And I instantly liked Augusta when I came here. It's really easy to drive. It's a small city. But it has landmarks. It's got eateries. It's got some great restaurants. And it had the apartment that I wanted. It's in an apartment complex, but this specific apartment is a two-bedroom that's in a standalone building. So we're actually physically separated from the rest of the renters in this complex, which was perfect for me because, one, I have a podcast and I need to be able to control the sound, but also we're kind of a loud family. We have some cats. We have a baby. So this is perfect for us. And so we negotiated our cats with the landlord, and we managed to get in to this apartment in Augusta, Maine. Now, I'm not a fan of renting in Maine. In Maine, there are no renter protection laws whatsoever. Basically, they can, if they want you out, they can get you out within 7 days. So you only have a week to get your shit together, which is like, if anybody who's ever negotiated a lease with an apartment knows that that's pretty much impossible to find a new place unless you have family to move in with. You know, our goal is just to be here for a year, two tops, and then by then have bought a house. We're looking to either buy a house or buy some land where we could build a house. And so this is more of just like a staging area for what's to come for us. But we do like it here. We love that we found the perfect sort of transition place. And I get to explore a city I never really knew. You know, there's a lot in Maine that growing up in Portland, I was never introduced to. You know, I looked at apartments in a city called Lewiston, which is a pretty sizable city for Maine. I'd never been there before. I'm like, this city was here the whole time as I was walking around. I'm like, wow, why hadn't I ever been brought here before? Augusta too. Like, why hadn't I been brought here before? It's the capital of Maine. Not even a field trip to the state house. We have the most accessible state house of like really any state. Yet the schools I went to never bothered to bring us here to teach us about civics and representative government and all that stuff. And it's just like, I'm going to get to know Augusta. And so I've been really getting to know this city, and I really love Augusta. I think it's an underrated city, not just for Maine, but for anywhere. It's really quite pleasant. And I know I'm probably running the risk of pricing myself out by saying that, because, you know, people will, they hear things like this and then they flock to a place and then everything gets jacked up and out of control. But I really think that the idea of moving to a city I've never lived as my way of getting back into Maine was the right move, because it really adds to the sort of on my own terms sort of approach where I'm getting to know a part of Maine I didn't already know. Therefore, I'm not coming at this with the same bad habits I might have developed growing up in the Casco Bay region. And, you know, I've really been thinking about this over the past few weeks since I've been here, because I moved here like 2-3 weeks ago at this point. And so I think 2 full weeks we've been living here. So we're about to start the third week. It's Sunday, so we're at the start of the third week. But I've had at least 2 weeks to really think about it. And, you know, when I drove down to my sister's house in Gorham, Maine, last week to pick up some of the totes I had stored. And I got enormous anxiety the moment I got off the highway. See, my highway exit to get to her house is Gray. Gray, Maine. That's the name of the town, Gray. And the moment I got off in Gray, I felt that anxiety. And I'm like, oh, this is why I can't immediately move back to the Casco Bay region, because I'm already flooded with this anxiety from just years of living in that area, years growing up there, going to people's houses there, going to relatives' houses there. You know, to me, they're not fond memories at all. They were chores. Going to visit relatives, growing up was always a chore, because deep down I knew they didn't really want to see us. They were visiting with my parents, and we were just kind of there. We were expected to not be seen or heard, you know. That's the sort of vibe that growing up was like for me. So when I go back to these areas, towns like Standish, Windham, I get enormous anxiety driving around them. Now, Portland, I'll get some of that, but Portland has changed so much and come up so much that I don't really feel it as much as I used to. Like when I used to come back on the Greyhound right after moving to New York, I used to get it. I used to get it a lot more. But Portland has just done a 360 flip that I'm just like, wow, this is not the same city I left. Sometimes, though, I'll get it down on Commercial Street. When I'm walking along Commercial Street or I'm at Casco Bay Lines Ferry Terminal, I'll definitely get it there, because as much as that area has changed, it still feels like the same place, you know, because when I was going to high school, I had to use that ferry terminal twice a day, every day. And so that was part of my commute. And so, yeah, they redeveloped the terminal to a certain extent, but it still feels the same. And it's so weird. 20 years later, I can go in there and people who haven't seen me in 20 years will recognize me. Like, I'm fat now. I wasn't fat when I left. I don't look at all the same as I used to, yet somehow, some way, these people recognize me. And I don't know how. I know they're not subscribed to my podcast. I know they're not subscribed to my YouTube channel. They don't listen to my content. They don't watch my content yet. Somehow, some way, everybody recognizes people even 20 years later. And that to me is also just like, you know, I don't have anything against most of these people, but like, I don't know. I just, being recognized by people from your past is rough sometimes. And I get anxiety about it. And so, yeah, I think winding up in a city that is kind of undiscovered by that area of Maine and, you know, that I'd never been to, I'm able to sort of build my own story of being in Maine that is apart from my parents. And it's becoming clear to me over the past 2 weeks that if this is going to work out, this is how it's going to have to work out. It makes the most sense. And I'll have more to say about it at some point in the future when I've really gone through this process, when, you know, this, maybe when this era wraps and we actually buy a house, I'll be able to better articulate these feelings that I've been having. But I am here, and getting here was rough. Let me tell you about it. So after we put the deposit down for the apartment and we lock in our lease, they gave us access to the apartment a week before our initial lease start. So, you know, my goal was a Labor Day weekend move. We ended up having to do an August 1st lease start. And so they gave it to us a week before August 1st. We paid a little extra for that. And so for that week, you know, I basically had a production the week before our move. I started making the monster movie. I don't know if you guys know about that, but I was going to talk about it. But I'll talk about like that week before the move after this. So I'm trying to compartment everything that I talk about in the podcast. But I basically shot the first vignette of the monster movie, packed up all my gear. This was in Long Island, New York. Drove back to New York City, unloaded all my gear, slept for 2 days over the weekend. That's not what happened. Oh my God. Like I'm already convoluting this. Okay. So what did I do? All right. So the week before our move, I gave myself 5 days to shoot this vignette, but it was so hot and muggy, I streamlined my entire production, ended up doing it in 2.5 days. Then I went back to New York City on Saturday. I think it might've been the 22nd of July. I don't remember. No, it wasn't the 22nd. I don't know if I'll edit this. I probably won't edit this because I just don't have time, but. Oh, it was the 22nd. Wow. Shit. All right. So the week of the 16th, I shoot the first vignette of the monster movie in Long Island, New York, which I will talk about. I gave myself 5 days. I gave myself Monday the 17th through Friday the 21st, but I ended up wrapping up on Wednesday the 19th and leaving the morning of the 20th, which is a Thursday. I unload all my gear in my apartment, and then on the 22nd, I drive out to New Jersey. This is a Saturday, the 22nd. I drive out to New Jersey, and I record my friend Greg Vorob. I do some audio recording of him doing the voice of the monster for the monster movie. We basically recorded all the final dialogue for the vignette I shot, but then I also recorded dialogue for all the other vignettes as they're currently scripted, with the idea that they're just a guide track for my future editing needs and that we would probably re-record it down the road. But I also kept in mind that if they're good enough, I won't need to re-record it. And then I packed up the audio gear for transport to Maine. On Sunday late, this is the 23rd of July, I left New York in my sedan around 10:45 p.m., 10:45, and drove all night. In my car, I had all of my film equipment plus some really important breakable stuff that belonged to both Jan and myself, including our mirrors and things like that, because we didn't want them being transported in the moving truck. And I arrived to Augusta, Maine at some point in the early morning hours. And I just walked around until I got a text from the management company, instructions on how to get the key and get into the apartment. And I ended up getting into the apartment pretty early, unloaded all of my film equipment, unloaded all of our more breakable stuff. You know, I had a way of hiding all of the stuff within the apartment so that they were sort of safe. I wasn't sure if we were going to get movers to help us or whatnot. So I wanted everything sort of compartmented and safe. And then I drove back. I slept for a few hours. And then I drove back to New York City. And I spent a couple of days packing. I didn't arrive back to New York until like Tuesday at midnight, but this is now the 25th. It's a Tuesday, 25th of July. I start just expediting the packing. Now, keep in mind, I've been packing for several months. I was ready to move months ago. So I've been packing for several months. A lot of my totes had already been transported out of the state and put up in my sister's garage. A lot of that was like home movies, for photographs, negatives, you know, things that I didn't want to get lost during the move. This was all very strategically done. Next would be the U-Haul trip. And so the U-Haul gets picked up, I want to say Thursday the 27th, right in the morning. See, what happened was I went to U-Haul on the 26th to buy some boxes, and I had reserved a 10-foot truck. But I saw the 10-foot truck, and I'm like, that is a really small truck. There's no way we're going to get everything if we get that truck. And I needed to upgrade, but the guy wouldn't let me upgrade. He said I had to call. And so when I got back home, after I packed up the TV, I had Jan call them. And I'm like, I need you to upgrade this truck, because I did it through the app, but I need it confirmed. And then I'm glad she did, because immediately the woman was like, oh, the app shouldn't have confirmed that, because there's no trucks available where you need to pick it up. And then so they arranged for me to do a pickup in Newark. Now I've upgraded to a 15-foot truck. So I go out to Newark the next morning. I Ubered out there, and it's one of those, it's not like a real U-Haul place. It's actually a tow truck company where you do a remote pickup with your phone, and then you get the keys from the company. But nobody told me to get the keys from the company, from the tow company, because they had those lock boxes out there, and you were supposed to get a code to the lock box. And there was a little miscommunication, and I was getting really frustrated. But also, there was also a lot of documentation needed that they didn't tell me I was going to need, but I just happen to have because I'm really paranoid about bureaucratic processes. For example, you should only need your driver's license. But for some reason, when you're doing the remote pickup, they also wanted a passport. I just happened to have my passport. I really locked out. But man, I would have been so pissed if I hadn't been able to pick up that truck. Because, you know, I didn't bring my passport. Like, who carries their passport around with them domestically? But anyway, I ended up with the truck. I drove it around the Port of Elizabeth for about a half hour just to get familiar with it. Tried to get gas out there, but it's all the gas stations around that area are for truckers, and they were not going to let me in that line. I think truckers resent U-Haul people. And then, so I just got on the Jersey Turnpike, took the Gothels Bridge into Staten Island, fueled up there. And then I just followed the trucking route back to my neighborhood. I'd been driving that trucking route, with my sedan for years. So I knew it very well. I knew what I couldn't do with a U-Haul. And after some finagling with parking spaces, I managed to get a really great spot right on my corner where I started loading the U-Haul with my stuff. And then eventually, Tony comes. Tony is the boyfriend of Lyndall, who does the scores for my films. She did the score for Death and Life and Fractals. And she sent Tony to help because Tony knows how to move. He knows how to pack a U-Haul. And boy, this guy worked his ass off for a couple slices of pizza. And I couldn't be more grateful. I don't know if I would have been able to get it done without him, to be honest. We packed everything we could. Jan took apart the elliptical trainer, and then we brought that down and managed to pack that too. I was really skeptical of whether or not we were going to be able to take it. But what we ended up not taking was one, our microwave. One, we didn't need it. Two, it was kind of a shoddy microwave by this point, and our new apartment has one, a really good one. My desk chair, which is really, really huge. It's a comfy chair, but it was just too cumbersome. And also wanted to leave it behind because Jan was going to be left behind for a few days while I did the U-Haul trip. And because she's nursing Sophie, I wanted to give her a comfy chair to sit in. Because I was also taking the mattress to our bed. So, yeah. What happened was Tony and I wrapped up the truck around 6 p.m. Tony bounced and I took a cold shower. It was more of like a cold rinse just to get the sweat off me because it was a really hot, humid, muggy, horrible day. and then I hit the road and I drove the same route I took the U-Haul in. I took it out of New York City, up the Jersey Turnpike, 80 West to Route 17 North, because you can't take U-Hauls on the Garden State Parkway that far north. And then I think it was 87 North. I think that's the highway that took me up to Albany. And then eventually, though, GPS took me off the highway around Troy, New York. And just like I was on rural roads from Troy, New York, all the way through Vermont and then New Hampshire, winding me down through Concord and Manchester. And then I didn't get on the interstate again until Portsmouth, New Hampshire. At which point you're on 95, which takes you onto the main turnpike at the Piscataqua River Bridge. Yeah. I can never pronounce that fucking word. The Piscataqua River Bridge. So I know there's Piscataquis County. So I guess it's the Piscataqua River Bridge. Anyway, I get off in Kennebunk. I meant to go to the Kennebunk Service Plaza to refuel, but I took a right instead of a left at the exit, and I ended up exiting the highway altogether. And so I found a gas station, like right there. It was closed, but I was able to refuel with a credit card anyway. And then I couldn't find a bathroom, so I made my way into the woods and took a leak. Danced around the parking lot for a little bit, the gas station parking lot, because I just really needed a stretch. Meanwhile, I've never driven a U-Haul before. So this 15-foot U-Haul, navigating this all this way, I am just so relieved I made it to the state of Maine. I just had this one last leg to go, and it was the middle of the night. Wee hours in the morning, I tell you. So I get back in, go to the highway, have a little bit of a cock up with the tolls, but I go through it anyway. I'm like, they'll just bill me, whatever. Everything billed through U-Haul in terms of tolls is billed as a violation for some reason. And, you know, I can do another episode about how much I hate U-Haul after this experience. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. But anyway, I'm back on the highway, and I get to Augusta at about 4:15 a.m. Park the truck right outside the building, right outside. And I just go in and check to make sure my equipment's still here, because, you know, my film equipment is the most valuable stuff I have. It's going to make or break my ability to have a future here in Maine. And it's still here, which means I am the only one who has access to my apartment, thank goodness. And then I try to sleep, but I can't, because I know I have a flight in that evening. This is now Friday, okay? It is Friday, July 28th. The wee hours of the morning. I know I have a flight at 6 p.m. and it took me all day to load that U-Haul. It could possibly take me all day to unload it, especially since I don't have Tony. My sister isn't coming until about 8 or 9 a.m. given her schedule. And so I'm like, you know what? I can't sleep. I got to just like power through and unload this bastard. And so I just start unloading it. Meanwhile, I haven't slept since I went and got the U-Haul in Newark the previous day. But I start unloading, and I get most of it unloaded. All the books that we own are in boxes. I unload those boxes. I unload all of our remaining stuff, and except for some big stuff. I tried to unload the dressers, but the dressers are too finicky. I managed to get one onto the grass, but it sat on the grass until my sister got here to help me. But when my sister was on her way, I'm like, hey, can you bring coffee and a donut? And she just, you know, she sent back the laugh emoji, and she knew what I was dealing with. And I'm like, I just really need a cheerleader and help with the bigger things, and then we can go to breakfast or something. And she was like a really good cheerleader. She was the best cheerleader you could possibly have if you're in that state. And she did exactly what I needed. She helped me get the elliptical out, helped me get the dressers in, the baby dresser as well, her changing table. She was very inventive about troubleshooting some things. Like, I couldn't get the crib into the bedroom that I wanted it in because it didn't fit through the door. But her being a homeowner, she knew the ins and outs of how to do stuff like this. She just got a screwdriver, took the door off the hinges. We moved the crib in, and then she put the door back onto the hinges. And I'm like, I wouldn't have thought to do that. And she goes, that's because you have a landlord. You've always rented, and so you're not allowed to do stuff like that. But as a homeowner, I had to learn how to do that. And she told me this really great story about how one of her sons, when he was a teenager, slammed the door in anger. And so she responded by taking the door off, and he was without a door for like a month. He's like, you don't get a door on your room for a month. And I'm just like, oh, that's so your lived experience has taught you how to be a better operator. That's the kind of like advice I need, especially when we eventually buy a house. But we ended up going to breakfast at a local spot here in Augusta. And then I got a text from the airline saying that my flight was canceled and I was rescheduled for Saturday, which meant I was going to have to couch surf with my sister. And I'm like, oh man, I'm too tired for this shit. Can we just like wrap up breakfast and race to the airport and see if they can get me to New York sooner? And she's like, absolutely. I'm sure she's sick of me couch surfing by this point, because, you know, looking for apartments in Maine, I was couch surfing with her every time I had to come up here. And so I managed to get some shut eye as she drove me back to Portland. It's about an hour, give or take, depending on your route. But she drove me back to Portland. I managed to get some sleep. Woke up at the Portland airport, PWM, and went in. And I'm like, look, I just need to get to Newark. and I know you guys got a flight in the afternoon. Can you just throw me on that? And they just quickly turned it around. They put me on that. It was a crappy flight. You know, it was rough. It was a slow to board. It was an aisle seat, and I'm a big guy. I like to be at the window, you know, so that I can feel like I am part of this world. And when I'm in the aisle seat, I feel very claustrophobic and like I'm just luggage. And so I can't do it, but I did it. And I managed to kind of keep my bearings. I need to know where I am in the world, which is part of the reason I like to be at the window. But I managed to keep my bearings by looking over at other people's windows. The people on my left had it open occasionally. There was a kid who was controlling it. He was more into moving the shade up and down rather than the actual view. And then the woman on my right kept it open because she was reading and she liked the light. But I managed to identify the highways, the river systems. I identified the Connecticut River and later the Hudson River. I was able to identify the bridges along the Hudson River, namely the Bear Mountain Bridge, as well as I-80, the highway that I was on just the previous night. You know, on final descent into Newark, you go over I-80 sometimes, especially coming in from the northeast, if the wind direction is appropriate. And that's what we did. And I managed to look over at the kid's window on the left side just in time. He puts the shade up just in time for me to see Manhattan, the Manhattan skyline from the air, thick in smog. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm glad I'm leaving. The smog was just insane. You know, when you live with it for 20 years, you kind of forget what clear air feels like, what it looks like, what it tastes like. And I'm just like, thank you for reminding me why I'm bouncing. Like, I don't want to raise my kid in that level of smog. So this is the second leg of the move, you know. Like, I've already done the trip to New York to Maine twice in 1 week. I got to do it one more time. So I finally get an Uber from Newark back to Staten Island. Go to my apartment. Jan's there with the baby. And I sleep. I like crash hard. And I wake up the next morning. And it's now Saturday morning. And I'm like, I'm ready to leave. She's like, we can't leave. You know, we've got too much stuff to do. You know, Jan's departure will be, she's going to take the baby Sunday morning and she's going to fly into Portland where my sister's going to meet her and the baby. And then my sister's just going to take them to the apartment and they're going to arrive to the apartment basically with everything that Missy, my sister, Missy and I moved in and all the boxes that I moved in. And as strategic as I tried to place all the boxes in the appropriate rooms, for the most part, it's going to just be shambles. It's going to be a mess. And so I won't be there to kind of help navigate where things are. So my sister is scheduled to meet them and run errands with them before they arrive at the apartment. My goal on Sunday, this is the very last day that we're going to be in this old apartment, right? This is Sunday the 30th of July. After I drop Jan and the baby off at the airport and say goodbye to them, I drive back to Staten Island. I go to the grocery store and I get some stuff for my road trip. This is my final road trip for this move. This is leg number 3 that I'm preparing for. I also go to one of the Italian delis to get some things that I've always wanted to try that I never got time to try while I was living in Staten Island. And I also get some supplies from some other stores that I'm going to need to wrap up this apartment. Because we are hell-bent on getting our deposit back. We've never gotten a deposit back from a previous landlord before. And I'm like, we're going to get our deposit back for this even if we have to fight for it. Because we've been here 8 years and everything wrong with it is wrong with it because it's been just one landlord special after another or just the landlord not wanting to tackle the problem. And so I went back to the apartment, and as I'm sorting things into the car, I'm keeping in mind that I'm also going to have to bring my cats, and that I'm not, you know, and then I have to also let things go because I'm not going to be able to get everything. Like my desk chair, I was never able to bring my desk chair at all. It ended up getting tossed, along with a few other things that I really wanted. But ultimately, I managed to pack as much as I could. That it's mostly supplies and stuff by this point, like paper towels and things like that, cleaning supplies. I mop up every room. Like I'll mop up and clean out the closet in the bathroom, and then I'll do the bathroom, and then I'll close that up, and then I'll do the bedroom, close that up, and then I'll bag the cats up, bring them down. Then I'll quickly do the floor in the living room, which is the main room. Kitchen's already been done. The kitchen was done before Jan even left, so that's all good to go. And I take video of everything. I take pictures of everything. And all this happens within like 10 minutes. And then I go downstairs. The cats are just in their carriers in the downstairs area of the apartment building. I load them into the car. And then all of the remaining stuff, like blankets, pillows, sheets, all that stuff gets stuffed between the carriers to kind of stabilize them, because these guys are about to go on the road trip of their lives. They've never left New York City before. They've never been on a road trip this long. They've only ever been to a local vet for one thing or another. And so once everything is packed in the car, everyone's there, everyone's snug, I do one check of the apartment again, one check of the building, and then I drop the keys in the rent drop box and I email the landlord the letter. Jan and I wrote them a really nice letter ahead of time, and I copy and paste it into the email, and I say, "We are gone. Keys are in the drop box. Here's where to send our deposit." And I check the trash area to make sure everything in the trash area is as organized as it can be. I'm really bending over backwards not to make this like a shoddy exit that most tenants would do. I hit the road at like around noonish, maybe a little before noon. And I drive all afternoon into the evening. And I arrive, you know, for some reason, getting to Maine on this trip was just tough. Everybody was on the road. I went up the Jersey Turnpike, took a right onto the GW Bridge, and then I went up north a little bit more via the Major Deegan Expressway to the Cross County Parkway, to the Hutchinson, to the Merritt. And this was like not the most efficient way to go. The traffic was insane, and it took a lot longer than it should. But at the same time, like sitting in traffic on the bridge I was okay with it, because I knew it was the last time I was going to have to do it. Like the next time I go to New York, it's not going to be like that. I'm going to be flying in and just cabbing everywhere or taking the train everywhere. But like this is the last time that I have to move out of New York, really, with all my stuff and my cats and my baby and all that. So I just kind of enjoyed it. I just kind of took it in. You know, it's been a long week. This is my third run in 1 week. So I just kind of let it wash over me. And eventually, you know, I'm going up the Merritt Parkway. All the rest stops are full with cars. I guess this is sort of like we're approaching the end of the summer at this point. So people are taking their last sort of weekend trips to wherever they have to. And, you know, I make my way up, you know, the usual route through Hartford, and then the Charlton rest stop is where I finally am able to use the restroom and get a coffee or whatever. Charlton, Massachusetts rest stop has been a staple of my trips back and forth from New York to Maine. I know it very well, both ways, in both directions. It's not quite the halfway point, but it's the one that I always used to take a break at. And then I would continue on to Maine. And at the very last minute, as I'm approaching the Augusta exit, the cats wake up and start howling. They're fucking sick of it. I'm sick of it. I'm like, "We're almost there, guys." And I text Jan to open up the back door and be ready. And then I pull in to the same spot pretty much where the U-Haul was. Originally was. I moved the U-Haul out front of the apartment several times to try and get it as close to the front door as possible when I was unloading it, but I think it was near the original area where I had parked it. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. You can't envision it, so it doesn't even fucking matter. Jan comes out and just opens the door and starts retrieving the cats. And I start unpacking the rest of it. And I'm just like, oh, we're here. We're done. The cats are a little traumatized, but they'll get over it once they realize they're in a better place and that the air is fresher and that there's a lot more room. But we're done. And the past 2 weeks have been unpacking, adjusting, figuring out how to work in this space. I haven't quite fixed the office up yet. The office is basically the bigger bedroom in this two-bedroom apartment is our office. And right now it's mostly just my stuff. She's got her work set up at the kitchen table because I have to get her a desk. The reason we got me a desk first is because my video editing and audio editing equipment is much more complex. And it needed to be removed from the box and set up in order for me to be able to make sure it's still working and operational in time for an upcoming project. Whereas, you know, basically she works out of a laptop, a single laptop, which she can work from anywhere if she has to. But she will eventually get a desk that is identical to mine. And it'll be on the other side of the room that I'm currently in right now. So let's talk about the projects. Let's talk about the projects because we are here now. And it's freaking amazing to me that we are here now. And, you know, I'll probably talk more about being here, you know, down the road and things that we've been doing. But.
You want to say something about Eric? He's recording.
Eric is the greatest director there ever was.
Bullshit. All right, so let's talk about the film projects that I'm working on. Prior to moving, literally a week before I moved, I wasn't even in the zone of relocating. I had to come out of that zone temporarily to make the first vignette of my 6-vignette monster movie. I think there are 6 vignettes. I actually don't remember. It's all in this big notebook that I have organizing the whole project, which I haven't looked at in quite a while. But the week before I moved, I got my equipment together and all the props that I had built and the set pieces. And I drove out to Long Island, New York, all the way to the North Fork, or at least where the North Fork begins, to a place called Baiting Hollow. Baiting Hollow is right on Long Island Sound. And it was a hot, muggy, mosquito-y week and place. And I gave myself 5 days to shoot the first vignette. The first vignette of this monster movie is 17 pages long, okay? And so I gave myself 5 days, but the conditions were so unbearable for me as an asthmatic, as somebody who's really sensitive to the climate and to the immediate environment. I'm just like, I couldn't handle it. So I really streamlined my production and I got it all done in 2.5 days. Was not ideal. However, I did get everything I was supposed to get. I got everything in the script more than once over. I even did some pickups. I made some time for everything. I wouldn't mind if I could do another couple of takes here and there, especially on some of the more dialogue-heavy scenes. But I really just needed to power through it. And ultimately, this vignette was done first because it's the easiest to be done. It's the one with the lowest stakes in the whole movie, although a part of it is integral to understanding the ending. So, but we managed to get it all done. And then I packed up everything into my car with the intention of not having to re-unpack it. So I was basically when I wrapped up the shoot, I packed my equipment for relocation, went back to New York City, moved all my equipment back into the apartment, and then went about the move as I just explained it. So what is the monster movie? The monster movie right now, it's billed under IMDb as The Fabulous Monster of Sacarapa Falls. That is not going to end up being the title. That is just a title I'm playing with. Because the film is nowhere near finished, I figured we'll probably go through several variations. I've already gone through several variations of the title in the writing process. It's just, this is part of this monster movie process, is I just don't know what the hell the title is going to be. However, we'll get there. I'm going on hiatus with it, though, because I have another project that I'm going to be doing this autumn, which I'm now gearing up for, and I'm about to talk to you about that. But the plan with the monster movie is I'm going to assemble this vignette. I've already started working on it in the editing, and then I'm going to put it away for a while. And then, come spring, I'll do the next vignette. And then in summer, I'll do another vignette. And then next autumn, I'll do another vignette. And then in the winter and spring of 2025, we'll do the final. And that'll be that. Because it has to be a multi-seasonal thing. The reason I'm taking a break, though, otherwise I'd just keep working on it if I could. But the problem is, it's not a problem, really. It's more that I've had an opportunity to do a project that I was supposed to do a few years ago. I'm having that opportunity to do it this autumn. So, as some of you know, I was supposed to go to Virginia 2 years ago to make a movie. A couple years ago, during New York lockdown, an actor that I had networked with before the pandemic, he had reached out to me and asked me to write a script for him that could be done in isolation, because he had access to a cabin in the woods, sort of a retreat. And he had this idea about doing a movie where it was just kind of him and a story revolving around him dubbing around the cabin, dubbing around the woods. And I wrote something that I thought was really great. It was called The Year Up. That was a working title. I hadn't figured out what the title was going to be yet. And it was about grief. He was grieving the loss of his late wife. And the way it was structured was that you had one side of it was him grieving the loss of his wife in a cabin in the woods. This was a cabin that he had rented to kind of get away from it all. He didn't particularly want to go, but the people he worked with, or at least one of the co-owners of his company, forced him to, because he was just bringing down everything at work. He's like, everybody's depressed because you need to really go work this out. So he goes out to the woods, and some things happen, which I'm not going to go into. And he eventually falls in love with this cabin and makes the owner an offer for it. And that's sort of his arc. That's part of his arc, is that he becomes like more interested in being in nature than he was before. But there's also like a religious component to it. There's this idea that we're playing with, where he is very intolerant to religious belief. He's an hardline atheist, very much like me. whereas his late wife was religious and very open-minded spiritually. And so the other half of the movie would be their flashbacks to their relationship, how they met, and how it's all rooted in these debates that somehow, some way, she managed to keep peaceful despite his intolerance. And with everyone else, we see that he is very incapable of being peaceful. But with her, he's capable of being peaceful. And we see their relationship evolve through these flashbacks until her death. And so I'm sort of playing with this idea, though, of division in society between those who have faith and those who don't. And, you know, I'm also just kind of exploring my intolerance to it, too, to a certain extent. Not as much as I have in some of my creative writings. But anyway, that was the film for a long time. But it got put on hiatus because the story I'm told is that the guy's wife had to have a tooth pulled or something. And that it was going to cost them a lot of money and they couldn't get involved with the production and yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, okay, I believed it for a while, but I didn't believe it after I managed to get my own version of the production up, which is what's happening now. Is I ended up having this epiphany last spring where I'm like, what if rather than having it as a cabin in the woods, where I would go to Virginia to do it, the rural hills of Virginia, which I'd never even been to. I kind of wrote in broad strokes here. It's a cabin in the woods. It could be really anywhere in North America. What if I brought it home? And by home, I didn't mean New York. I was living in New York at the time. What if I brought it to my home state of Maine, and instead of it being a cabin in the woods, it's a cottage on an island in the Gulf of Maine? Because I'm positive that if I try hard enough, I could find a rustic cabin-like cottage on an island in the Gulf of Maine. I am from that area. I know a lot of people. Well, it turns out that there aren't really that many left. In the 20 years I've been gone, Casco Bay specifically has evolved to the point where it's pretty much just another Swamp Scott or a Cape Cod or a Hamptons, you know. Back in like post 9/11, when a lot of people started buying up properties there and building their dream homes, because, you know, everybody realized life was short, I called it the Hamptonization of Casco Bay. And then over the next 20 years, while I wasn't living there, that actually happened. And if you go to Peaks Island, for example, a lot of the houses are reminiscent of the types of homes you would see out in the Hamptons. But there are a handful of cottages out there. And so I started reaching out to people. And the first person I reached out to was the songwriter for Fractals. As some of you might know, if you listen to the podcast, the entire music squad of Fractals is rooted in a song called No Sense by a fellow named Eric Anderson. And I reached out to Eric as a flute, just to see what could happen. I said, do you know anybody with a cottage that is sympathetic to the arts? That's the key phrase. They have to be sympathetic to the arts or it's not going to work. And, you know, he did some digging and he managed to give me a great cottage, which I'm not going to go into details yet, but it is on an island in the Gulf of Maine. And we are set to film from late October through November. We're going to film everything that was supposed to be in a cabin in the woods will now be on an island cottage. Not insulated whatsoever. It really is rustic as can be. It's not been winterized. And actually, because we're going there so late in the season, we're going to have to board it up for the winter when we're done. That's the caveat. Not only do I have to get insurance, which is fine. I got insurance for the vignette in Long Island, so I figured out how to do that. But I'm also going to have to work with this other Eric to winterize it, which I've never done because I've never owned, and I probably will never own property with the way the world is. But I'll have the opportunity to at least learn how to winterize someone's property, which I'm very much looking forward to. And I think I'm looking forward to the knowledge that will be gained from learning how to winterize a cottage. I think I'm looking forward to that more than making the movie at this point, because I've made the movie in my head several times over, when I drafted it, when I wrote it, and then when I rewrote it for this version. And by the way, the cottage we're going to already has a cinematic history. A movie has already been made there. So I went ahead and when I redrafted the script for this location, I integrated that into the new version of the movie. And it helped me find my title. You know, this is an island in Casco Bay, right? Casco Bay is in the Gulf of Maine, in southern Maine. Well, the coordinates for the Gulf of Maine is 43 degrees north by 70 degrees west, or 43-70. Everyone who lives out on these islands knows that that's the coordinates. Even if they're not a mariner, they somehow know that these are the coordinates to get back home if they're ever lost at sea. And I just thought, you know what? We're going to call this film 43 degrees north. And then, of course, I ended up doing another version of the script where the coordinates become integral to it. And again, I'm not going to explain what happens while he's out on this island, aka in the woods, but there is something that transpires where the coordinates become important. Whereas in the first version that was set in Virginia, the coordinates weren't important at all. So I would say that even though I wrote it for somebody who kind of flaked out on me and that the production didn't work out, I was able to find an even better opportunity to get the movie made and improve the script tenfold. I mean, probably 100-fold. It's like immediately it's a better movie by being in a place that I'm more familiar with. Immediately it's a better movie because it's more personal now. And it's a better movie from a cinematography standpoint because, oh my God, this location on the coast of Maine, this is a historic turn of the century cottage on its own peninsula. And I'm going to have access to it for 3 weeks to film an entire indie film. And a no budget indie film. Nobody has opportunities like this anymore. I'm not going to throw it. I'm not going to flush it down the toilet here. I'm not going to just fuck this up. Okay. I'm going to bend over backwards to make this the best film I could possibly do, given the fact that it's a no-budget film. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, oh, a no-budget film, Eric, come on. I don't think you fully understand. If that's what you're thinking, you don't fully understand that. You know, most of us have biases against no-budget films because the people that make no-budget films, for the most part, are first-time filmmakers who don't 100% know what they're doing. And it's very rare for somebody to get more than 20 years worth of experience and still making movies who don't have a budget. Usually you make your first film and then suddenly you're able to generate budgets out of that. That hasn't been my case. I'm a completely different case study. Okay. So my idea of a no budget film is just another film that I'm making. Only I'm making it with a lot more experience, and because we live in an era where, you know, I've lived through the proliferation of high-definition technology, I've lived through the invention of digital cinema technology, I now have access to that, I've built up my production gear over the past 20 years so that I have a fully functioning studio at this point, so that it's not like the equipment isn't taken care of. I have the most professional equipment an indie filmmaker could possibly have. I have a prime cine lens set, 6 lenses in the set. So I have all the primary focal lengths I could possibly need. I shoot 6K digital cinema raw resolution. I have backup cameras. You know, they're not as good as the main camera, but they're damn good. If in a pinch, I could really make it work. So that's taken care of. The key, yes, I needed to make this movie happen, the location, that's taken care of. All I got to get is insurance. That's the last thing I have to do. And then the casting. The casting is now taken care of. I just had my first production meeting with my lead actors. The first part of this podcast where I was talking about the move, I hadn't had that meeting yet. This is being spliced in sort of after the fact because I wanted to make sure that the film information is as up to date as possible by the time this is released. So that's probably also why you might have noticed the change in my demeanor or in my tone. It's because I have a little more energy than I had when I was winding down the conversation about my move. But yeah, so this movie's happening now. It was supposed to happen during the pandemic. I was supposed to drive down to Virginia with my production package and collaborate with this guy. And it just didn't happen. And, you know, I offered this new version of it to him, by the way. I did. I offered it to him, but he couldn't do it. He just, and I, this is when I felt like it wasn't really about the tooth. It wasn't really about money. It wasn't really about anything. I think that the story I ended up writing freaked him out a little bit. Because it, you know, playing an atheist who's really critical of religion requires, at least in my version of it, requires him to say some scathing things that even in the pretend context of acting in a movie, For some people, it's just too difficult. And so that's what I think the real reason is, because I do know that, like, his parents-in-law or his wife's parents are really, really religious. And so I think that that might have been the real reason. And, you know, as James Altucher has said in some of his podcasts, there's the reason and then there's the real reason. And the real reason they'll hardly ever really tell you. And so my guess on the real reason is that the religious content freaked him out, at least the religious criticism of it. But, you know, I'll never know. People aren't usually forthcoming with their honest feelings about things. They try to be diplomatic, which is fine. Without diplomacy, we wouldn't have society. But it doesn't help me. You know, had I known the real reason, I wouldn't have offered him the second version of this project. But that's okay. You know, I ended up with a fabulous actor that I'm really, really looking forward to working with and seeing what we can do. You know, at our first production meeting, he promised me that we would work hard to make a really human film. And I loved that. I loved hearing that. And so he's already knows what's going to happen. He knows what has to happen. And he's also game for the tough part of the shoot, which is basically going out to this island to a non-winterized cottage in the off season in the Gulf of Maine. It's going to be cold. It's going to be nippy. It's going to be grueling to a certain extent. I mean, I'll try to make it as nice as possible, but it's definitely not going to be the easiest shoot. But boy, the footage is going to look gorgeous. And if we do everything right, if we do right by this screenplay, it's going to be a great film too. So this is 43 degrees north. And somehow, some way, I'm going to try to engineer a way to film it or film parts of it on every serviceable island in Casco Bay. You know, my point of origin is one of the islands in Casco Bay, not the one we're filming on, but I'm going to probably pick up some shots on that island, as well as some of the other neighboring islands. And some of my cast members are coming from the neighboring islands. And so, hell, why not call it 43 degrees north? This is my homecoming movie, after all. First project I'm making after having relocated back from New York after 20 years. Exactly 20 years to the month. So, my homecoming movie, I think it's the perfect project for it. It can't be the monster movie. The monster movie is a different animal. The monster movie is rooted in my art house sensibilities. I need the homecoming movie to be geared more towards the audience. And that's what this is. 43 Degrees North is very much an audience movie. Whereas the monster movie, you know, if you're into monster movies, you'll probably dig it. But for the most part, it's kind of a mixed bag. I'm making it more for me as much as for anyone else. Whereas 43 Degrees North, like, the only part that I'm really making for me is the fact that it's a homecoming movie being done where I grew up. But other than that, it's very much a movie geared towards other people. The monster movies, yeah, oh God, it's too much of a mixed bag. So I think, though, that that's what the structure of my creativity is going to be moving forward. I'm going to try and overlap my projects in a way where, you know, I have that sort of a long-winded art house production that I'm doing that'll take a long time to do. That's more for me. But then I'll have those short burst productions that will be done for the market. Now, they'll all go to the market, but they're not all being produced for the market. And so 43 Degrees North is a short burst production. We're doing that in like a month or so. Probably maybe a month and a half of combined dates overall in terms of production. And then it'll be done. Post-production will go on past the holidays, of course, because it just is what it is. But ultimately, there'll be no more shooting after the holidays. It's done. Monster movie will continue to shoot in the spring, summer, fall, mm-hmm. and then possibly next winter. And then by then, I'll have hopefully had another quick burst project ready to go. I've got a bunch ready to go, and I've got a bunch more I'm writing again. Like, it's a never-ending thing. I'm going to end up dying with a whole bunch of unproduced scripts. It bugs me to no end, but I'm trying my best to get these things made. It's not easy when you're a no-budget filmmaker, when it's part of your regular life, you know, and not a career, and you don't have investors like lining up outside. It's inevitable that, you know, I'm going to have a lot of scripts left over, but I am trying my best to mine the most meaningful content out of these and get them produced. And so that's what's happening now, is hopefully moving forward, I'll be able to overlap them. There's the long-term art house project and the short burst audience-driven projects, and it'll just go on like that constantly. And, so you'll hear a lot of updates moving forward about 43 Degrees North, and going into the spring, you'll hear some updates about the monster movie, because now that that's officially underway, I know before this, it was all just talk. It was all just developing. Well, now we got the first vignette in the can, and the second vignette is well on its way. In fact, I'm already negotiating a Zoom call with the owner of a location that I'd like to use over here in Maine for that monster movie next spring. So cross fingers and wish me luck, and I'll see you on the next episode, everybody. Thanks.